Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello there and welcome to Africa Link, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Africa Link.
Coming up, Cameroon's military recaptures two villages once held by separatists, which the government has labeled terrorists.
We have been supporting the government, but nothing is coming. That's why we all are annoyed. Do you want us to be happy with the government? No.
And the Palestinian armed group Hamas calls for an uprising after US President Donald Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
Certainly, Israel will be on high alert in the coming days, especially all eyes will be on Friday for the Friday prayers.
And we shall be talking to one man who is giving Western Union and MoneyGram transfer services a run for their money.
Stick around for these stories and more right after we hear other stories making headlines around the world.
I am Kai Dambach with the DW News. Zimbabwe presented its new budget after former President Robert Mugabe was removed. Our correspondent Columbus Mavunga has this report.
Presenting the budget, Minister of Finance Patrick Chinamasa said fighting corruption and re-engaging the international world was key to reviving Zimbabwe's battered economy. Chinamasa announced plans to amend the indigenization law, which was introduced by former President Robert Mugabe to reward blacks who were disadvantaged by colonialism.
The proposed amendments will confine the 51.49% indigenization threshold to only two minerals, namely diamond and platinum.
Protests broke out throughout the Palestinian territories and across the Middle East after U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Hamas called for a new uprising against Israel in retaliation, starting Friday. The group said in a tweet that the decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital was a declaration of war against Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised Trump's decision and said that other nations were following the U.S.'s lead in recognizing Jerusalem. Liberia's Supreme Court is expected to determine whether there will be a rerun or runoff in regards to the October 10 presidential and legislative elections. A runoff was previously scheduled for November 7th, but the Liberty Party demanded a rerun of the elections, claiming voting irregularities and fraud. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international public broadcaster. Kenya Attorney General Githu Muigai warned of grave consequences if an unofficial president was sworn in. He said it would be an act of high treason, punishable by death. Muigai's statement comes just days before opposition leader Raila Odinga said he would be sworn in as president. Odinga was not deterred by Muigai's words.
We as Kenyans will solve the Kenyan problem as Kenyans. And we are talking on behalf of millions and millions of Kenyan people. The will of the Kenyan people is not going to be stopped. It's unstoppable. We will move and we'll do what is right for the people of Kenya.
The Libyan ambassador to Uganda, Naima Al-Jihan, denied reports that migrants and refugees were being sold as slaves in her country.
The ministry expresses its rejection of such inhuman actions, which are contrary of the culture and heritage of the Libyan people. And the ministry confirms that what has been published in the media in this regard is under investigation by the Libyan authorities. And if these allegations are proved, all these involved will be punished.
A CNN report in November showed migrants being sold in Libya for as little as $400 a person. The Australian Parliament passed a marriage equality bill on Thursday, becoming the 25th nation to recognize same-sex marriage. The law was passed 146-4. After the measure was passed, lawmakers and audience members broke out into song. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull praised the decision. It is expected to be signed into law in a few days. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dambach.
This is DW's Africa Link. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. We are live on Facebook too, so do let us know what you think of the stories we are covering today.
We start off in Cameroon, where the Cameroon military has taken over two villages held hostage by people they describe as terrorists. The suspects had been collecting taxes, rendering justice in their law courts, and sentencing people who refused collaborating with them to prison time. Moki Kinzeka visited the two villages in the English-speaking Southwest region and reports.
Life is slowly returning to normal at the Bafia Market Square in Fakot Division of Cameroon's Southwest Region. It is one of two villages that local government authorities said was occupied since September by people they describe as terrorists. The region is smearing with anti-government sentiments after it declared independence and the creation of the so-called Republic of Ambazonia. Emmanuel Che, a primary school teacher, says before the armed separatists came, they had sent notices warning people from collaborating with the government.
When we came here, we saw tracks warning us that we should stop what we are doing on this campus, and that people who have children should remove their children. Gave us about 48 hours to do so.
From Bafia, I went on a motorcycle to Moyenge, another village that the armed separatists occupied for a month. Resident Ayuk Lucas says the secessionists were sanctioning and judging anyone who did not obey their rule.
They even create a court, everything, a whole government, where they send bike to come and collect somebody, send it and ask you to pay some money to them.
Despite the recapture of the two villages by the military, supporters of those who are calling for independence are still distributing tracts that preach their doctrine in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. Moyenge resident Ebune Francis says the armed separatists were expressing anger over the total negligence the government of Cameroon has manifested on the English-speaking regions. He, however, says he does not support secessionists, but stands for the early demands of a federal state that were made by teachers and lawyers when they began a strike that degenerated with separatist demands a year ago.
We have been supporting the government, but nothing is coming. That's why we all are annoyed. We are abandoned by the government. We don't have water. Sometimes we don't have electricity. You want us to be happy with the government? No.
Moki Kinzeka reporting.
And Zipporah, as always, these stories from this region in Cameroon always brings a lot of reaction on our Facebook page. Charles Dabite says, Anglophones are not fighting to remove President Paul Biya from power, but to restore their independence declared on 1st October 1961.
John Chumbaka Ebuche says, it is unfortunately a fat lie that the people of the Federal Republic of Ambazonia have vowed to loosen Biya's long grip on power. We are not a political party, but just a marginalized minority.
And another one here from Michael Chi Sawayer says, separatists are 99% of the population and 1% of the separatists are those who are armed and who want an immediate separation. And he goes on to say that killing the 1% armed separatists does not kill the struggle for separation.
Finally, one last one here, which sums up, and Dele Fatuyu says, the Africa Union is silent and innocent people are being abused by security forces.
Now, talking of security forces, let's move on to Israel. Aggression, unhelpful, an act of war. This is how world leaders continue to react to the decision by U.S. President Donald Trump to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Israeli security forces had to use water cannons and tear gas to disperse protesters on the streets of the West Bank after the Palestinian armed group Hamas urged supporters to carry out an uprising. Turkey has described the move as trampling on international laws.
With more on the backlash, DW's Sarah Kelly has been speaking to Tanya Kramer, DW correspondent in Israel.
Yeah, there are clashes reported all over the occupied West Bank, in Bethlehem, in Hebron, that's in the south, but also in towns in the north. Also in Gaza, along the fence that encloses the Gaza Strip, and also some clashes here in East Jerusalem. These are usually the friction points, between Palestinian protesters and the Israeli army in the West Bank, or here with the border police in East Jerusalem. Now, the Palestinian Red Crescent has said that there are reports from injuries from rubber gas, gas and tear gas and rubber bullets. In addition to that, there's also a general strike in the major towns here to protest this decision by the U.S. president.
And we understand that even bigger clashes may be ahead. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, certainly Israel will be on high alert in the coming days, especially all eyes will be on Friday for the Friday prayers. Everybody here is bracing for fallout of this decision. I mean, we don't know really yet what will happen, but especially in East Jerusalem after the prayer services, you know, they are expected that there might be clashes between Palestinian protesters or coming back from praying and the Israeli security forces here. But, you know, there's still a sense of uncertainty how big this will become and what will happen.
Tanya, just tell us the likelihood that this violence could escalate.
Well, I mean, we heard the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh speaking this morning in Gaza, and he called to launch a third intifada, an uprising against Israel, against also this to protest this decision by the U.S. The question is, what will be really the response on the streets? Now, we are seeing already the clashes today, but how big will this become? How, you know, organized this will become? And I think also the Palestinian leaderships on both sides, Hamas and Fatah, they're also under pressure because they have been fighting each other for the past 10 years. They didn't deliver nothing as well to their people. So it's a question, you know, only the next days will tell us how big this will come, this will become, and if this call for a third intifada will be headed by the people as well.
Tanya Kramer, DW correspondent in Israel.
Now let's leave the international world and move to the money world. Digital money transfer service WorldRemit aims to increase its customers fivefold to 10 million in 2020, with half of them in Africa. WorldRemit, which is based in London, enables its immigrant customer base to use digital financial remittances to bypass more expensive cash transfer options from the likes of Western Union and MoneyGram to send money home to families and friends. WorldRemit Chief Executive Ismail Ahmed was born in Somaliland. Having received $40 million in new funding for his company, he's been telling me how he intends to invest the money.
This will be used to drive the next phase of our growth. As part of our expansion, we are planning to enable individuals and businesses in Africa to send money abroad as simply as sending an instant message using WorldRemit app. Somaliland is a country which heavily relies on remittances, and when I grew up in the capital of Somaliland, Hargeisa, like many other families, we were recipients of remittances from the Gulf. Many relatives, you know, even my brother used to work in the Gulf. So that was what I got really interested in, remittances, because remittances transfer formed Hargeisa in the 80s. And when I came to the UK to study, I became a sender and got a first-hand experience of the costs and inconvenience of sending money back home. You know, like many other migrants, I had multiple jobs. I was a full-time student. And when you're busy and doing many jobs, it becomes inconvenient if you have to travel to small shops to send small amounts of money regularly. So that was really sort of, it was what I experienced that led me to come up with a better ways of sending money. According to the World Bank, inter-Africa transfers are the most expensive corridors in the world. And we want to change that and make sending within Africa cheaper and more convenient.
WorldRemit founder Ismail Ahmed in London.
And now, Crispin, I think we should revisit the first story today of Cameroon government, which has ordered thousands of villagers to leave their homes in the Anglophone Southwest region. And we asked why are Cameroon neighbors silent on the conflict?
That's right. And we have a lot of comments on our Facebook page, even on our live podcast. And many of them are actually questioning the report that we've just aired, saying that it's the military which claims now to have recaptured these two villages. They don't agree with this story from our correspondent. But that's also understandable. I mean, we do cover the story from both angles. And if you don't favor it, doesn't mean that it's a lie or it's wrong. So we still have comments coming in. And there is one here from Chenuna Marshall, who says, where is the dialogue the whole world has been preaching when these things cannot even be discussed in their gagged window dressing parliament?
John Ezugwebu says, Cameroon's neighbor Nigeria is silent because it's facing similar challenge, but doesn't know about the rest of the countries.
That's right. We have another comment here coming from... we'll leave it at that. We are running out of time, but we'll keep those comments coming in on Africa Link, and we'll read them whenever we can.
Well, in case you've joined us, you are listening to Africa Link, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Still to come, Rwanda to start using DNA tests to apprehend men who defile teenage girls.
It is a very serious problem. We mostly get to know when the victim gives birth. We have been doing DNA testing in Germany, and it's very expensive.
We have got lots lined up for you, but first we take you to Ghana, where Ghana's president Nana Akufo-Addo is marking a year since he was voted as president. He won the presidential election in December of 2016 by a landslide margin, defeating an incumbent president. But his victory was realized largely due to his numerous promises. So, a year after winning that election, how has he fared? Isaac Kaletsi in Accra has more.
President Akufo-Addo won the December 2016 election after promising to build factories in each district of Ghana. He also pledged all constituencies $1 million each. 1 year on, these promises are yet to be fulfilled. However, the government has begun the implementation of its flagship campaign promise to offer free education to all senior high school students. Other initiatives like digitalizing the Ghanaian economy and reforming public services are slowly taking place. On the streets of Accra, there is mixed reaction on the president's performance so far.
There are certain things he promised, and I think he's fulfilling some of them. So we take it like that. I think as time goes on, he will do everything for us. So let's take what he's doing for now.
So far, it's not bad. I think it's good. I've seen one or two policies he has implemented. If he could do something about the fuel prices, it's skyrocketing. With corruption, I think it's not something that can be uprooted right now, but so far, so good.
It may not be that bad for Akufo-Addo's supporters, but his critics accuse him of allowing the formation of vigilante groups which are causing chaos after failing to get jobs that had been promised. Matthias Intu, a lawmaker from the opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC, says the president has failed to improve the living standards of Ghanaians.
Economically, you can hear how people are suffering, how people are lamenting.
But Dr. Kwabena Chumnuama, a leading member of the ruling New Patriotic Party, downplays the criticism from the opposition. He says it's too early to judge the president's performance after only 12 months in office.
We haven't gotten there yet, but we still have 3 years more to go. We are hoping that in the incoming year, some of these programs will be actualized.
A promise to prosecute corrupt officials has also not materialized. Kwame Dansoe Champon is a political analyst and says, with the high expectations among Ghanaians, Nanadu would have to do more in the coming months.
If you look at the passion towards the fight against corruption, you would come to the conclusion that a lot of it has remained rhetoric. However, it is important to acknowledge that when it comes to using technology helps solve a problem of a country, the government has shown some attempt and interest in solving that aspect of our lives. In general, it is difficult to mark the president beyond 40% in terms of deliverables and actual performance on the ground.
40% approval rating is more or less the same figure that U.S. President Donald Trump has had for a while. For President Akufo-Addo, time to deliver on his promises is slowly but surely ticking away.
Isaac Kalechi reporting from Accra.
And Zipora, some comments on Akufo-Addo's 1 year since he won that election in Ghana. Amo Kieran's child says he's still on the job doing fairly well. At least some of the promises he made have been fulfilled and some are yet to be done. The political atmosphere in Ghana has changed since he took office. Overall, I will give him 48% of the job done so far.
That's a good percentage. Ayuri Boinga Joseph says on the jobs he promised, he has delivered by removing suspected opponents and replacing them with party members.
And Amin Ayamga says he promised one district, one factory, one village, one dam, $1 million, 111. None of these promises have been honored. The free secondary school he forced on Ghanaians has led to congestions in schools.
I have to wrap up with Joseph Abredu, who says he's the kind of president our nation needs to accelerate economic growth and development.
Yuzon.
Girls in Kakamega, Western Kenya, are pedaling into the future with what has been called the wheels of empowerment. Bicycles are changing the lives of girls in the rural parts of this country where poverty, poor infrastructure and gender inequality has seen many drop out of school. In large parts because many of them have to travel more than 5 kilometers just to get to school, which has also put some girls at risk of sexual predators. Andrew Wasike visited the Holy Cross Injira Secondary School and Lugala Secondary School and filed this report.
16-year-old Diana Mulemi lives in Shinyalu village in the heart of Kakamega Forest. Mulemi's days start at 5 a.m. with daily chores of fetching firewood, cooking and cleaning. Her brother does not have to do these chores and can leave the house 45 minutes earlier. Then starts the long trek of 5 kilometers to school, where the risks along the way are many. She once boarded a motorbike taxi, but the man hiked the fare, failure to which he started demanding sexual relations in exchange.
Being a girl, it has been so difficult because there are some people who may attack you on the way, like in this forest.
A recent report from the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child shows that Kakamega County is the second in cases of child-headed households in Kenya. Most girls drop out of school as some communities continue to cling to laws and traditions that force them into early marriage or child labor. But all this is changing due to a simple gesture that has seen girls receive bicycles to allow them faster and easy access to school. Turkey, through its development arm, the Turkish Cooperation and Coordination Agency, TICA, has donated 200 bikes to 2 schools in the region. Mulemi is one of the lucky few. She says for her, the bike is just not a tool to get her to school, but what she calls wheels of empowerment.
It will be so easy. I can reach school in time and I can perform well academically. Since I have been given this bicycle, I'd like to be a doctor.
This year alone, 20 girls from Lugala Secondary have dropped out of school. But Patricia Mutuva, the school's deputy head teacher, hopes easy access to school will change things around.
Some of them walk as far as 8 kilometers from school and back. And now we have a challenge facing us because of motorcycle riders who give these girls lifts to school. And we have had a lot of cases of dropout, girls dropping out because they have been impregnated by the motorcycle riders. Some of them get into early marriage. These bicycles are going to make a difference for our girls because we are now very sure that our girls will all finish school and they will perform quite well.
Emre Yüksek, head of the Turkish Cooperation Coordination Agency, says the initiative of giving bikes is to ensure girls get equal education opportunities like the boys.
This gesture is aimed at enabling access to education, reducing the time taken to go to the school, and improving secondary school enrollment among adolescent girls.
Simple as a bike may seem, girls here are excited about its impact on their lives.
DW correspondent Andrew Wasike reporting from Western Kenya.
Speaking out.
Between 2016 and 2017 alone, an estimated 17,000 Rwandan underage girls were reported to have temporarily dropped out of school as a result of unplanned pregnancies. While the government and civil society have joined efforts to rehabilitate and support these girls to go back to school, the men suspected of being responsible will soon begin being subjected to mandatory DNA tests to determine their culpability. From Kigali, our correspondent Nasra Bishumba filed this report.
A survey on child defilement in Rwanda, carried out by the National Human Rights Commission, indicates that most of the perpetrators are mainly relatives of the victims, educators, and members of the public who the girls meet on their way to or from school. Jean-Baptiste Muhire, a father of two, says the law should be harsh on those found guilty of sexually defiling and impregnating teenage girls.
Personally, I think the families of these teenagers should also be held accountable because most of them decide to keep silent to avoid conflict, even when they find out that someone has been abusing their child. I suggest that if someone is found guilty of this, they should be given a hefty sentence so that they can serve as an example.
The head of the gender unit at the National Prosecutor's Office, Agnes Muhongerwa, says while there is currently a national sensitization drive to encourage more people to report such cases, her office was also pursuing the use of DNA tests to bring those responsible to justice. Last year alone, her office received close to 3,000 cases on girls' defilement countrywide. She says having a local forensic laboratory will help resolve the issue.
It is a very serious problem. We mostly get to know when the victim gives birth. We have been doing DNA testing in Germany, and it's very expensive, but the facility here is complete. The forensic experts are already trained. The equipment already arrived, and what remains now is tying up loose ends before we start doing the tests ourselves. DNA tests will help us bring those responsible to justice more easily.
The chairperson of the National Human Rights Commission, Madeleine Nirere, says cultural norms are making defilement a challenging crime to pursue.
Those that are being abused mostly fall between the ages of 15 and 18. However, we have also seen cases of younger girls. We are now in the process of registering the babies and their mothers so that we can continue to support them to go back to school. Culture continues to be a challenge in these matters, with many people choosing to keep silent about defilement or teenage pregnancy for fear of stigma.
That report by Nasra Bishumba was presented by Sela Oneko.
Right, and now let's go back to social radio. And another story that we didn't manage to cover today is actually taking place in Tanzania. 38 members of Tanzania's main opposition party, including two lawmakers, have been in custody for a week following local elections, their lawyer said on Wednesday. And we asked you on Facebook, you know, is President John Pombe Magufuli becoming a dictator?
Yes, and the comments have been overwhelming, Crispin. I have to start with this one from Carly Silva, who seems to agree and says, Magufuli is not a president, he's a bad leader. In Tanzania, no equality, no freedom in any way, and no democracy.
But Abdallah Abubakar Bitam Simili says, this is what Westerners do. They brand our leaders as dictators, our elections flawed, our democracy as teething. All for what? To get rid of African leaders who wouldn't take their nonsense. I like my Africa, even though we have lots of leadership problems.
But a contrast here, Crispin, coming from Peter Mabado, who says, John Pombe Magufuli is slowly becoming a dictator, using militias and police to suppress the opposition. He should give space to the opposition.
And Othman Yahaya asks, so arresting people for illegally assembling and damaging properties is now dictatorship.
And Igwe Henry says, it's only in Africa we are hearing such issues. African states are independent on words, but depending on Western countries on action.
Right, and just next door in Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has said he supports extending a president's term to 7 years from five. But one critic says any such move would help enable one of Africa's longest-serving leaders to rule for life. And we asked you, what do you think of it? Iyob Shakaya says there is an African saying that says when the gods want to kill a man, they make him mad.
Napuro Basua says this is obviously an invitation to anarchy. The greed of men have caused them to always act like no one else is good enough to lead their country.
And Abdul Shakur says, DW Africa, a large number of Ugandans don't support this term extension plus age limit removal. Take an example. I'm a graduate, was born under Museveni's rule, so I want to see a new face as president, but in peace. Zimbabwe gave us the best example.
That's always good to hear from the people on the ground. Abdul Shakur says a large number of Ugandans don't support this term extension plus age limit removal.
And Isaac also says, I hope the army in Uganda can do something to stop this from happening. I don't know whether he really means that, like now a coup. I hope it doesn't happen because we know what a coup can also lead to.
Von Thunen Bismarck says, those are visions of potential dictators.
Right. Thank you for listening to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. Bye for now.